Nicholson, Reel One. And if I could ask you first of all then about your family background, where were you born?
I was born in Romford, and just outside Romford in Essex, which is, in a wartime context, close to London Docks. And I think that's why, because there was nothing around us, housing estates and so on, there was no reason why bombs should have dropped on us. But as you know, during the war, the navigation wasn't that great in cloudy weather, dark weather. The German bomb aimers would drop their bombs where they thought the docks were. Or they would perhaps be liable to lack of moral fibre and not go as far as the docks and drop their bombs before they reached the docks. Or if they couldn't find the docks, would drop them anywhere near the docks. So we had a fair amount of bombing around us at the time. And there were ACAC batteries around us too, and there were the famous balloons around us. And, you know, I can remember, I mean, the nearest pom-pom, we used to call them pom-poms, ACAC battery was only about a half a mile away, if that. So it became a very familiar boom, 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 you know, that sound all night. And the searchlights, of course, we had these enormous searchlights. So, you know, as a kid, the war was very exciting for me. And we all used to love it. You can imagine in the morning after the air raids, all the kids used to go out looking for shrapnel and bits of this aluminium that they used to throw out of the aircraft to confuse the ACAC people, reflecting in the searchlights so they wouldn't be able to see the bombers. That floor, the ground was covered in it. And I remember the incendiary sticks that used to litter the road in the green. And in those days, we had these huge water tanks, massive water tanks in the road for the fire service to use in case of a house on fire. And sometimes these would be blown apart. And sometimes, of course, we'd use them as swimming pools and imaginary fishing expeditions. It was great fun. So the war, to me as a kid, you know, was a very exciting place to be around in.
About your father, was he in the war?
My father was in the war. He was a lighterman in civilian life. My only remaining relative, Aunt Ethel, tells me that he was also a member of the Communist Party. But then I think if I'd been a young man in the 20s, I might have been a member of the Communist Party too. And it was because of his political activities that forbid my mother marrying him. So they had to run away to get married. My grandfather was a very strict man and probably a Tory, and was outraged that my mother should, you know, even consider marrying a man of his political persuasions. And they ran away to get married. So it took some time to forgive them. But to answer your question, yes, he because he was a lighterman, because of his knowledge of tugs and the river and water, he joined the Royal Engineers and went up to Scotland in preparation for D-Day and learnt, I forget the name of the place, but there was a place in Scotland that taught people all about landing craft, how to land troops, how to negotiate the beaches. So he did his training in Scotland, and I gather was one of the first to land Indian Day. I was told he was a beach master, but I don't think at the time he landed, I think he was a captain. And I got a feeling that only the majors were beach masters. I can't be certain. But he's certainly he was one of those who helped to bring the landing craft ashore. So he was in the front line from the very beginning and stayed in the front line as a sapper with bridges and also the anything to do with rivers, crossing rivers as the forces advanced. He was in the front line, so he saw a lot of action. And then after the war, when the war finished, he was put in charge of the inland waterways of a certain part of northwestern Germany, Friesland. And he was in charge of IWT, Inland Water Transport, and by then he was a major. And we were the first British family to arrive in Emden. Not the first British, of course, but because he was a senior officer, he brought us over, and I think it was early 46. So we were the first British family, to be in Emden, and I remember it very well. I mean, the devastation was just absolute. I remember my father being on my father's shoulders, and I remember him saying, look, if you look carefully, you'll be able to see one side of Emden from the other, and it was that devastated. I remember the Germans living in cellars, and my father organized a hare shoot. You can imagine, because there'd been no hunting except of each other during the war, the countryside was put full of game. And my father organized a hare shoot, and they brought in something, thousands of hares and rabbits, which my mother and other mothers, other wives, made into huge stews to feed the Germans. And they used to line up real soup kitchens, but the Germans were that hungry. And we would give them our bread and cigarettes and things to... it's amazing. People forget just how devastated the Germans were when we moved in.
You would have been then of school age, wouldn't you?
I was at school age. 46, I'd have been, nine, wouldn't I?
What had happened during the war, you know, to your education? Did this continue in the Romford area?
No. I went to a usual primary school. You know, I've forgotten its name now. It's quite some time ago. So I don't remember much of the schooling then. And of course, schooling was pretty sporadic at the time. But I do remember going to school in Somerset. I was evacuated to Somerset. I remember, and it is astonishing, you know, I'm 64 now, so I forget when I've left my glasses, or, you know, I put a spanner down and I can't, and why am I in this room? But I can remember, long-term memory comes back very vividly now. And I remember, it's very hard memory, isn't it? You often wonder whether what you remember happened or whether you've embellished it. You know, fond memories become even fonder if you can start putting little bit of snippets of nostalgia in. But I'm sure I do recollect being put on that train in Paddington with lots of other kids. And I can remember my mother in a raincoat, you know, fussing about me. And we all had little manila labels like a parcel around our necks. I think I remember, as I wrote in an article, I remember being upset at the time because, you know, we all kids wore shorts in those days. And my mother had made these shorts. She made all our clothes in those days. During the war, you had to. I had a pair of long pants. You know, by long pants, I mean underpants, which were longer than my trousers. So I do vividly remember, you know, being terribly embarrassed by all this and trying to roll up my pants under my under the short trousers, which concerned me more than saying goodbye to my mother. And I do remember, I'm sure I do, as the train pulled out, her turning around very suddenly. Instead of waving on the, you know, waving until the train had disappeared, she simply turned around fast and walked quickly away, because, you know, she'd lost her husband who was away. My two older brothers had also been evacuated. Now, I was being evacuated, and all that was left was my sister Jacqueline, who again was to be evacuated later. So there she was, left on her own. And I remember writing that, and it's true of all mothers all over the world, isn't it, that in order to save their children, you know, they have to lose their children. And she lost her entire family during the war, for the duration of the war. But she had to lose them to save them. But the schooling in Somerset was... again, it was an idyllic existence for a boy from, when I say Romford, you know, it was bordering Dagenham, which isn't, you know, huge housing estates. It was a pretty bleak place. Essex generally is a pretty bleak place. But to suddenly be dumped into the countryside in this wonderful old farmhouse, surrounded by, you know, toy animals, as they seem to be, And it was a lovely farmhouse. It's still there. I sometimes go back to see it.
What part of Somerset would it be?
Well, it was between Wells, which is a lovely town, and Wedmore, or Cheddar. It was a place called Thiel, T-H-E-A-L-E, Thiel. And it was simply, there were seven farmhouses and a small village shop and the big, you know, the big country house. And opposite the farmhouse, it was Yew Tree Farm, was a small wooden hut where Bill Kick lives. Now, you know, I can often not remember the names of some next-door neighbours, but Bill Kick, I can remember him. He was a cripple, he was a polio victim, but a huge top half. And he wore a huge leather apron, and he was a cobbler. And he lived all day in this small shack. His nose always seemed to be running, I remember, but he was a fabulous guy, and you know, told me an awful lot about the countryside. And I'd walk up the hill, literally opposite, directly opposite the house, the farm, and the school was on the top. It's obviously now been converted into, you know, the inevitable house. But it was a typical little village school there, mixed school. And I remember sitting in front of twins. There were a couple of girls who were twins. And I had my basic schooling there. But again, you know, it was wartime schooling. So my early schooling was virtually non-existent, like a lot of children at the time. So when I went to Germany, my father organized that we should have a tutor, a guy who came to the house every day to teach us as best he could, because my sister was with us then. Both my brothers were in the services by that time. I remember one occasion upsetting the German tutor who complained to my father, and my father took me down the cellar and whipped me with his belt. I mean, that was pretty normal practice in those days. I mean, you go to prison now for abuse, but that was discipline then, and that's something we accepted. I mean, I accepted it, brutal though it was. So it was pretty basic. Pretty basic. Then, within a year, they opened up a school for English children in Emden, and they had English teachers. But then I was transferred to a boarding school called Prince Rupert in Wilhelmshaven, which is an old German U-boat base. And the houses we were in, there were four houses. I was in Drake House. I think there was a Nelson House, and there was a Collingwood House, all named after naval people. And I remember during playtimes, we used to watch British divers with the great huge helmets, you know, the old-fashioned divers with the big brass helmets, and she diving into the old U-boat pens and pulling up the submarines that had been bombed, you know, and blitzed by the Brits during the war. So that was fascinating for us to be right in the midst of the war again, post-war. I enjoyed my school there, I must say. I was only there for a short time, year and a bit, I forget now, but... year and a half, but it was. I think it was being in the country, and being at that particular school, and suddenly achieving kind of established middle class status, being to a boarding school. I think that obviously geared me and made me what I am today.
It's interesting, isn't it? You know, bearing in mind your career, your profession was as a war correspondent. You know, you had a lot of early experience, didn't you? Both in the, in Britain and in the so-called enemy country after.
Oh, I can remember. I mean, I went around a lot with my father. I remember one horrific experience was when he was asked to supervise the digging up, the exhumation, and the transfer of the British dead. There was one grave where they'd been hurriedly buried, obviously some terrible disaster. 100 or more bodies were there. And he had to help supervise the exhumation of the bodies, for the transfers back to Britain or to a proper war grave. And I remember the smell. For a little boy, it was quite... And then, in 46, you know, wherever we travelled along the road, there would be... Well, obviously the debris of war, the tanks and all everything else smashed to pieces, blitzed towns and villages, and every now and again there would be a rifle, you know, stuck into the ground, barreled down with a helmet on the top, a German helmet on the top. So So we were as close to the war, as we could be, being there so early. And the Germans, of course, were very hostile. Children went, of course. I remember hearing German children playing outside the house when we first arrived, and hearing them laughing. And I remember then thinking, good heavens, German children laugh the same way we laugh. And I became very friendly with a boy called Edgar. He taught me German. I spoke pretty good German, I think, by the time I'd finished. As children do, they pick it up so fast, colloquial German. And I had no idea of grammar or conjugation. but my colloquial German was very good. So happy times. It was the canal at the back of the house. I remember it was 12 Königsberger Straße. And there was a canal, and every winter, of course, it froze like mad, and we would go skating along the canals, for miles.
Well, were there many English children there?
There were, eventually, yes. We've got photographs of Christmas parties at the officers' mess, and, there must have been 20 or 30 families there in the end, and they all had children. Kept up with some of them after when we came back, but lost contact after that. No, there were quite a lot of children.
Been in Germany during the Berlin blockade? Did that
No, I don't even remember that. No, I don't remember any of that. I mean, I was a long way from Berlin. No, I don't remember any of that. And my father wouldn't have been involved because, again, he was a long way from Berlin.
Yeah. Your father, was he absent all through the war? Apart from leaves and visits?
I don't ever remember seeing my father during the war. Okay. Now, that's not to say he wasn't there.
Yeah. Well, what was it like having a father, after all those years? Do you remember if you were impressed at all with your father's return?
No, I wasn't, for some reason. I only vaguely remember him in Germany. It's odd, isn't it? I can remember so much about inconsequential things, like Bill Kick's name, the twins that I sat in front of at school, but I can't remember much about my father. I don't think he was at home a great deal. He did a lot of travelling in Germany. In fact, much against the rules, and he would have gone into lots of trouble had he been found out, but he got a WAF's overcoat and beret for my mother. And they travelled together wherever he went, places she would go with him as, his secretary. And of course, she wasn't in the army. He had a very good German driver, Hans, who was later killed accidentally in a shooting accident. But they went together. It was very good. I got a photograph of my mother somewhere. She looks like a real army major herself. One of the astonishing things was that, because my father travelled so much, and because my mother travelled with him, he had a secretary who was a male secretary. He spoke absolutely fluent English. I mean, you imagine he was English. And whenever my father and mother were away, he would live in the house and babysit. There was a Dutch maid too, and so this man was privy to a great deal of my father's doings. And sometime, it must have been 6 or 8 months into that relationship, and I witnessed it, I'm sitting on the stairs, my father arrived back at home early one day, accompanied by two British military policemen and British plainclothes men, and they arrested this German secretary, I can't remember his name now, but they arrested him. He was already organising a Nazi cell in Emden within a year of the war ending. Excuse me. Astonishing, wasn't it? I remember them coming to the house and taking them away.
It's interesting too, your attitude, isn't it? Because I remember in the war, the propaganda about the Nazis and the Germans, and here you were sort of living in enemy territory. I wonder, how easy it was for you in the beginning, how you
as my father would say, no one was a Nazi. You never met a Nazi, you see. As soon as, once the war was over, once they'd lost it, they all denied being Nazis. So you never met a Nazi. There was hostility. I remember on one occasion, we were coming back from this school that had been set up in Emden, and we were walking home, and we passed a stable, and there was a man in the stable with a horse, and I think we wanted to get friendly with the horse, but he realised we were English, became very nasty, and then started swearing at us in English, effing and blinding in English. And then I think he slapped me or hit me, and the man was arrested, and I had to go to court in front of a British judge, a British military judge, and I had to tell them the story, and I had to repeat in court the words that he'd used, the F's and the B's, and of course I was in tears because of it. I don't know what happened to the man. British justice, I suppose, they slapped his wrists and told him not to let it happen again, but that was an unpleasant experience. But generally, you know, if we were walking down the pavement and they realised that we were English, they would step off the pavement. But then we were the victors. And I suppose that's how they were taught to act. Didn't last long, I mean. And soon they became our victors over us.
So, leaving school, what were your hopes? You know, what did you hope to do?
You mean when I was 16, whatever it was?
Yes.
I wanted to be a pilot. I had a fascination with aircraft, model aircraft and everything else, and I joined the ATC, the Air Training Corps. I remember being worried about my eyesight because I knew that pilots had to have incredible good eyes, so I ate lots of carrots, and I took a book out that said how to improve your eyesight, which meant spending an hour at a time with your eyes closed, looking into the darkness of the palms of your hands, with your hands covering your eyes. So I was used to go to all the air shows. I remember, and it's something that the first feeling of which has been repeated regularly throughout my life. I went to the Farnborough air show where John Derry was killed. I think that must have been in the early 50s, middle 50s, I forget now. Farnborough air show, and he was flying a DH-110, and it went up and it disintegrated. And I forget, dozens of people were killed. And I was very close by where one of the engines landed. And of course, he was my hero. He was a great test pilot at the time. And I remember I went to work that happened on a Saturday. I went to work on the Monday. And I couldn't understand, you know, how people could be so cheerful. I mean, people were walking around the streets and going in the buses and as if nothing had happened. Of course, to them, nothing had happened. I mean, they couldn't care a tinker's cuss about John Derry. Why should they? But to me, it was a major tragedy, and I couldn't make out why people didn't feel as mortified as I felt. And it was something that has struck me, you know, many times since. You go to places, like Rwanda, or like Bangladesh, or like any one of the great disasters, Ethiopia, Biafra, and you come back from those experiences and you see people on the plane and at the airports and behaving as if, you know, none of this was happening. And I thought, well, you know, either they haven't seen my reports or they have seen them and don't care. And you go into the local pub and expect people to be greeted, well, you know, we saw your piece, how dreadful it is, you know, I wish we could do something. You expect. But it's, oh, hi, where have you been? Oh, I've just come back from Vietnam. Really? Well, have a half, you know. And then the talk goes on to golf or, you know, the latest movie or the latest girlfriend. And it's something I've always found hard to live with, the coming back from one theatre of tragedy to those people who are very safely distanced from it and wondering why, you know, they don't care as much or whether they care at all.
Yes, and I suppose really, not having people to talk to, having shared that experience, is that difficult at times?
Well, you don't, as a rule, and it's not just me, I think it's the kind of rule of the trade, that you don't talk about what you've done with anybody else other than those who've done it themselves. I never talk about it to my sons, even though my son is in television himself. I don't talk about my wife or my friends. Generally, people aren't interested. And also, I have the feeling, and I know it's one shared by people in my trade, that if you told people what you'd just done and just seen, just heard, they wouldn't believe you anyway. It sounds too far-fetched. I've been up in the Lake District recently. I'm going back on Sunday, but I was up there last week and witnessed the destruction of the slaughter of these animals and the burying of these animals and the tragedy of the farmers and grown men weeping in front of you. Women completely stunned by it all. It had a terrible effect on me. I said to my wife, it has as much an effect on me as seeing a terrible tragedy in Ethiopia or elsewhere. Probably because it's happening to my own people, and it's always harder to cope with when it's happening to people that you relate to, your own people. But I would never normally not talk about it to others. That when you're with other journalists, of course, that's about all you do talk about. But you very seldom discuss what you've done or your business with people who, as I say, are safely distanced from tragedy and really don't have the imagination to know what it's like.
So this ATC experience, this was giving you some training, I expect.
Not really. No, it was. It's kind of Fred Karno's army. It's Boy Scouts in military uniform. No, not really. But it's something I wanted to do. I mean, I went in to the Royal Air Force hoping to become a flyer. I think that was what I hoped to do. But I didn't have the educational background. I didn't have the aptitude, and so I did national service. But thankfully, because I'd shown a great interest in flying. They put me into another ATC, which is Air Traffic Control, from Air Training Corps to Air Traffic Control, and spent 2 years. I went to Shawbury, which is the Air Traffic Control course, and eventually was transferred to Marham in Norfolk, which was the Bomber Command Master Aerodrome. We had Canberras there, and you're actually looking at the man who gave the final signal to send the Canberras off to bomb Suez. How about that? That was a very junior Irk, but because they're all Canberras that were flying from Marham to Cyprus at Akrotiri, Kalia, to refuel, and then went on to bomb Suez. And because of it was radio silence, I suppose our bosses imagined there were Arabs in the cornfields, with shortwave radios to alert Suez whenever our planes took off. There was absolute total silence, and it was all done by lights, time and lights. At a certain time, the first bomber would come out of Pan A and go to the runway and wait. And I'd be out on the balcony of the cupola with a red lamp and a green lamp, and I would hold the red lamp until the boss shouted, right, clear, and I'd then hold up the green lamp. So the final signal that the pilots got to take off to bomb Suez actually was from me, junior though I was. So that was my contribution to the debacle that turned out to be Suez.
Impression were you getting, on the airbase about that crisis? Was it a big flap?
No, it wasn't. I mean, it was a military. It worked perfectly. I know John Keegan has other ideas about it, but politically it was a disaster, of course, because the Americans decided to turn their back on it. But militarily, it went. According to plan, as most British military operations tend to do. We saw it simply, and as I say, I was very junior, but I know the pilots were cock-a-hoop about it all. It all worked perfectly well. Politically, it was a disaster.
Yes, well, was there much despondency when it was called off?
No, I don't think so. I mean, they did actually bomb, didn't they? And actually, I mean, I think at the time I seem to remember we had a cameraman, John Lane, who was a Marine at the time, and he was about to launch the attack on Suez, and we almost killed him with our bombs.